The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this is our last session on the qualities of the paramis, the 10 qualities that we cultivate, 10 of the qualities that we cultivate in our practice. Just as a reminder of these qualities, the qualities we've been talking about for the last 10 weeks are generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. So tonight we're going to talk about equanimity. As we go through our lives, a lot of what we meet day to day is success or failure. Something happens and we feel like we've done it well, or something happens and we feel like we've done it not well. We meet praise and blame. People tell us we're doing well, or people tell us we're not doing well. And we tend to react to these conditions. When we're doing well, when we're feeling successful, when people are praising us, we feel good. When we feel like we're a failure, or people are blaming us for things, we don't feel so good. There are what are called the 8 worldly winds: praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. And pretty much our life is a flow of these winds that blow through. And often we react to the blame, the loss, the disrepute, and the pain, feeling like something's wrong, I've done something wrong. How can I fix this? How can I get rid of this? And when something like success happens, when we're praised, or when their stocks have gone up, or when somebody's telling us that we're a success, or when there's pleasure in our lives, we feel like this is the way it's supposed to be. And when it's not like that, we think we've done something wrong. The quality of equanimity is the quality that allows us to be balanced around whatever is happening to us. These winds blow through our lives. Sometimes they're connected with what we're doing. Sometimes somebody will blame us for no good reason. And if our happiness is tied to the conditions of the world, we will suffer. So equanimity is that quality of mind that allows us to be balanced around whatever's happening, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. It's a non-reactivity to the pleasant, the unpleasant, and neutral aspects of our lives. When things are pleasant, we typically like them and we want them. More of that, please. When things are unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. Fix that, change that. Not in my life. So we're reactive in that way. When things are neutral, we kind of space out. We're bored. So this quality of equanimity is a balanced mind, a non-reactive mind, a spacious mind, one that accepts, has a quality of acceptance to what is happening in our experience. Sometimes equanimity is confused with indifference. That there's a kind of an idea that if I'm not reactive to pleasure, pain, gain, loss, if I'm not reactive, that means I'm numb. It means I'm indifferent. And that's not the quality of equanimity. The quality of equanimity actually allows us to feel more deeply the joys and sorrows of life. But it allows us to hold it with balance. So there's the feeling of it without the reactivity to it. So the mind that's equanimous actually can take in more of life's joys and sorrows. Because there's not, our heart's not closed to the joys and sorrows. And I'm talking not only of our own joys, but the joys of others. Not only our own sorrows, but the sorrows of others. So this parami follows the parami of loving kindness, of metta, that we talked about last week. And the reason, my understanding of the reason it follows metta, we talked about metta, we talked about kindness, we talked about compassion, we talked about the sympathetic joy last week. That in order to really be able to fully meet the joy and sorrow, in order to really, the full flowering of the quality of loving kindness needs this balance of heart and mind to be able to meet the suffering, to be able to meet the joy without jealousy, without resistance, without anger. It's a very beautiful quality of mind. The cultivation of equanimity. Equanimity is really the result of our practice. It is because of the causes and conditions that we have put together in our lives that equanimity can manifest. There's one series, the equanimity is found in a couple of different lists. And one of the lists it's found in is called the Seven Factors of Awakening. And when equanimity is found in lists like this, it tends to be the last quality in the list, partly because it is the one that takes the most time to cultivate. It needs the most practice to come to fruition. And it is also said to be the stepping stone, the balance of mind of equanimity is the stepping stone to freedom from suffering. And when we're not reactive to joy and sorrow, our mind is balanced and we aren't suffering. So one of those lists, the seven factors of awakening, equanimity follows concentration. So that's one way to look at how to cultivate equanimity. And I'll just talk about this one briefly because this is not the main support for cultivating equanimity. But it is a valid and a very powerful support for equanimity. So the concentration, there's two basic kinds of concentration. There's the concentration of settling, instilling the mind, for instance, on the breath, where we just come back over and over again to the same experience. The mind gets very quiet, very still. And in that kind of concentration, what happens is that the qualities of mind that disrupt us, qualities of anger, of wanting, of sleepiness, of restlessness, and of doubt, those qualities disappear as the mind settles and collects on a single object. And when those qualities of those five hindrances, the anger, desire, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt, when those disappear, there's very little reactivity in the mind. So in a sense, the cultivation of that stillness of mind gives you a taste or a flavor of that non-reactivity, because those hindrances are set aside for the period of time when you're concentrating on that experience of the breathing. So the hindrances being set aside gives you a flavor, gives you a taste of that non-reactivity, of that balanced of mind. That kind of concentration is pretty dependent on conditions. It depends on becoming quiet and settled and still, on the ability of the mind to come back to this object over and over and over again. So it tends to be a little fragile. The kind of non-reactivity that's cultivated that way is somewhat fragile. There's another kind of concentration that results from the mindfulness practice. When we are able to be mindful of what's happening in the moment and pull that thread of mindfulness along so that it becomes continuous. So that you're just noticing, this is what's happening right now. Pressure is happening right now. Seeing is happening right now. Hearing is happening. Pressure, dryness, vibration, just a steady stream of knowing what's happening in the moment. This is very different than the kind of concentration that comes out of settling on one object. It's a concentration that comes on changing experience. We essentially become aware of the flow of our experience. And as we become more continuously aware in that way, again, reactivity diminishes, because every time you come into the moment, there's something being experienced, and then the next moment there's something else, and the next moment there's something else, and there's not much time to react to each thing, because there's continually something new coming that the mind is aware of. So both of these types of concentration support the mind understanding and learning about this non-reactivity. We also begin in the practice of this mindfulness, we begin to understand and explore what it means to not be reactive to something difficult. Anger comes up in our experience. We can be mindful of anger and not be reactive to the anger. The anger is reacting to something, but we don't have to react to the anger itself. So in little tastes, we begin to get a sense of what it means to not be reactive, to not be reactive to our emotions, to not be reactive to pleasure and pain. Just this experience is coming up now. Just this, just this, just this. So the continuity of mindfulness is a powerful way to create the conditions to begin to understand what equanimity means. And you might just taste a little flavor of it. You're sitting in meditation and you hear the train. And you just hear the train. There's no reaction, no feeling that it's disrupting your meditation. It's just hearing arising. And in that moment, you have a sense of the flavor of equanimity, a balance of mind around just whatever is arising right now in the moment. So you can get a little taste of this quality of equanimity. Begin to understand what it is. A more stable kind of equanimity arises as a result of insight. There are two basic insights that I'm going to talk about tonight that support equanimity. The first is an understanding of the teaching of karma, which I will go into. And the second is an understanding of the teaching of anatta, or not self. And these are two of the most, can be two of the most challenging teachings in the Buddhist teachings. So I won't go into great depth on them because each one of these could be a whole talk in and of itself. But in order to understand equanimity, I need to talk at least a little bit about both of these two insights and what they mean. So the first, karma. Karma is essentially a natural law of cause and effect. There are several of these kinds of laws of cause and effect, and our experience, everything in our lives, everything in the universe, happens because of cause and effect. There are causes and there are effects. Causes and effects. And there's different kinds of causes and effects. There's the causes and effects of the environment, of kind of the physical world. There are the causes and effects of heredity. There's the causes and effects of the way the sense doors work. That if your eye is functioning and it's open, it sees form and color. Just very natural cause and effect. And then there's the cause and effect property of the mind, of how we experience our lives. The basic understanding of karma is that when we act skillfully, when we act out of kindness, out of compassion, out of generosity, out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, as we act out of those conditions, we tend towards happiness. If we act out of greed, aversion, or delusion, if we act out of unskillful motivations, anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, avarice, if we act out of those kinds of motivations, suffering will follow. This is how the law of karma is understood. Karma, the term karma, is simply translated as action. So it's really the law of action. So this has to do with the choices we make, how we choose to live our lives. We have a choice in every single moment of our lives how to step forward into the next moment. When we choose skillfully in this moment, we create the conditions, the results move us more towards happiness. If we choose unskillfully in this moment, the results move us more towards suffering. This moment, here and now, is the only moment we can choose. So this moment is where we step into the rest of our lives, and we have a choice of which direction we wish to go to. Now, we have this choice in every single instant of our lives, but mostly we don't see the vast array of choices we have. We notice at particular points in our lives that we have choice. So sometimes, because we can't see all the different choices that we make, it feels like we don't have control over our choices. It feels like we just get propelled into saying something without having a choice about it. Somebody says something to us and we respond with anger without even being able to stop and see that that anger is present before our angry speech comes out. The practice of mindfulness begins to open us up to see these choice points so that we can actually recognize when we're choosing, when we're choosing to act out of anger, when we're choosing to act out of non-anger. Every single action of body, of speech, and of mind has an intention behind it with a motivation that accompanies it. The easiest place to work with this in our practice is in the area of body and speech. So before we make movements of body, noticing what's the intention behind it. Before we say something, can we notice what's the intention behind it? We all experience the results of our choices, whether they're skillful or unskillful. And our happiness or unhappiness depends on those choices. The Serenity Prayer that you're all probably familiar with can be understood as a reflection on equanimity. May I have the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. What can we not change? We can't change the past. We can't change what has come up in the present moment. What's actually already coming up in the present moment. We can't change that either. We feel like we should be able to, but it's actually already here. It's here already. So we can't change that. And often we can't change the outer circumstances of our lives. We can't change the way others behave sometimes. What we do have the capacity to work with is how we choose to respond in this moment. The understanding of karma. When we understand karma, we understand that the feeling of what's happening now is a result of our past choices. Not everything that happens to us is a result of our karma. This is something that's often misunderstood about karma. That there are many different kinds of causes and conditions. I named some of them earlier. So the weather, for instance, there's an earthquake. That's not your karma that's causing the earthquake. How you respond to the situation, how you meet that situation is a result of your karma, of your choices in the past. I'll give a little example of this. It's a very simple example. And to help you see perhaps how this reflection on karma can begin to lead towards equanimity. So I was on retreat, and it was pretty early in my practice. And I was struggling a little bit with the silence and feeling lonely. And it was a big retreat. So there were, you know, maybe 100 of us or so, and we came into the lunch area, and all the chairs were getting filled up, and so I had to sit right next to somebody, and I picked the person I wanted to sit next to, person seemed like that they would be a very kind of friendly presence to sit next to. And I sat down and I was just sitting there feeling this friendliness, this friendly presence. And somebody else came and sat across from us, sat across from the person next to me. And I was kind of just paying attention to my meal, but out of the corner of my eye, I saw them exchange a nod, a greeting in a sense. And instantly I was plunged into a feeling of excludedness and loneliness, a feeling that I'm not part of the in-group or something like that. And for quite a while, I felt this feeling of depression, of exclusion, of just not feeling. I had gone from that feeling of friendliness and happiness to that feeling of depression and yuckiness in just a split second because of this exchange that had happened. And I sat with the feeling. I just experienced that feeling of that depression, of that loneliness. And at some point, this thought occurred to me. The phrase that occurred to me was causes and conditions. And that was a phrase that one of the teachers had used quite a lot on the retreat. Things are a result of causes and conditions. And I realized that there had been many causes and conditions that had come together to create that moment and to create my response to it. That essentially somebody else could have sat down there and been fine, even if they had witnessed the interchange. That the reactivity that I had was because of my history, my conditioning. That I had often been on the outside, not part of the most popular group or whatever. I'd often felt like I was a little bit on the outside all the time. And this had tapped into that pattern. When I saw this whole thing, and I also saw, too, that the interchange that had happened between them had been a result of causes and conditions that had come together for them. And it was just this whole thing. I was just kind of like, I saw this network of causes and conditions that had come together to create this experience. And as I saw that, I realized this is not personal. This doesn't have anything to do with me. This is just the fact of my own history meeting this experience. And in that, the feeling of the loneliness and depression went away because of that understanding of the way the causes and conditions had come together. So in a sense, in a very real sense, when we meet our experience, we are meeting ourselves. Any reactivity that comes up, we are meeting ourselves in that reactivity. So this is a place to understand, to explore. We can look at this meeting of ourselves as being a friend to ourselves, not as something to get rid of or cut out or exercise, but to meet and to be friendly with. That understanding of that experience will help us to learn how to not be reactive to that experience, which brings us back to equanimity. So for me, in that experience that I just described about the loneliness, the reflection or the thinking about causes and conditions coming together supported my ability to let go and not be so reactive anymore. So this is a very powerful reflection. Reflecting on the fact that what happens for us is a result of our past actions, our past conditioning. What's coming up now is a lawful unfolding that reflection can support the mind's ability to accept what's happening in the moment. Another aspect of karma that is sometimes misunderstood is that in the way we talk about it using conventional language of making choices and what happened to me in the past. So I make a choice, this happened to me in the past. We speak about it in that conventional way. But there is a danger, in a sense, of misunderstanding that people misunderstand karma and feel like it's like, well, if I'm suffering now, it means I was really bad in the past, and then beating ourselves up because something, you know, if something's happening to me now, it means I did something wrong in the past, and so I'm a bad person because of that. Well, that whole thing is revolving around a misunderstanding of I, me, and mine. And this points to the second insight that supports understanding or cultivating equanimity, and that is this teaching of not-self, of anatta. So when we have this misunderstanding of I am experiencing the result of my past actions, and I choose how to respond, there is a choice. It's not that there's not a choice. There is a response. There is an experience. But there isn't any single abiding entity that makes the choice, that feels the response, that chooses. And at each moment, there's a new unfolding series of conditions, of experience, and there is no abiding me here. Now, this one is really hard to wrap your mind around. And you don't have to wrap your mind around it. One of the great things about the teachings of the way the Buddha teaches them is he doesn't necessarily ask you to simply believe. He asks you to investigate. So look at what feels like me. Look at what feels like I or mine. And start noticing the different experiences that you have around those, or in that exploration. You won't find a single feeling that is me, because it doesn't exist. There's my own reflection on this. I discovered that there were some various familiar patterns that would come up. And it'd be like this pattern would come up of miserableness. Yep, that's me, miserable. When happiness would come up, that one I wouldn't identify with so much. That wasn't me. But certain familiar patterns would come up, and I would think, yep, that's me. That's the kind of choice I make. That's the kind of thing I do. This process there's a process that creates the idea or the belief in a self. Basically, it's a thinking process. There is this feeling of self, but it's created by your thoughts and your beliefs. So again, you don't have to believe this. It's probably not so helpful to believe it. But reflecting on it, reflecting on the possibility can be supportive, particularly if you look at sort of small aspects of your experience. Like, can you reflect when you're feeling a particular familiar pattern? feeling miserable. This isn't me. This is just a feeling that's coming, and it will pass. So reflecting on essentially the impermanence of the things that we identify with can help to kind of slowly dismantle this large feeling of self that we have. You know, we have this kind of generalized feeling of self, but you'll find that it's kind of attached to certain things. And if you pick one of those things to explore, that's particularly, you know, that you find is a place where you get stuck or caught, you start to explore that thing, you'll start to see that there are causes and conditions that create the arising of that feeling. A thought comes in the mind, and then there's a reaction, and then the feeling arises, miserable arises. Based on that thought and that reaction, there's miserable. You'll start to see as you look at places where you identify, where you feel a sense of identification. If you actually look at them, you'll start to poke holes in it. One of the great ways to poke holes in an identity like that is to notice when that feeling is not there. You know, yep, I'm a miserable person. And when happiness arises, well, that's not me. I know that's not me. I'm really a miserable person. If you can take in the fact that miserable isn't there in that moment, it's like it starts to punch holes in the belief that you are a miserable person, or whatever it is that you're working with. So the noticing when you identify with something, noticing the patterns around the identification, and then noticing too when it's not there. Noticing when that pattern is not there, consciously recognizing, oh yeah, actually I feel pretty happy right now. I feel pretty happy right now. The degree to which we understand that our notion of self is a pattern of thought and not an actual thing that needs to be protected or defended, to that degree we will experience equanimity. Because if there's no self to protect or defend, there's very little reason for reactivity. So this understanding is a huge doorway, gateway for this understanding of equanimity, the insight of equanimity to arise. In our day-to-day life, it can be helpful to use reflections to support this letting go of reactivity, to support this letting go of identification. Actually use thoughts. I know often in mindfulness practice, we talk just about being with what is. But sometimes we have trouble being with what is. If something comes up that's hard for us to be with, if there's reactivity to it, sometimes it can help to bring in a little bit of wisdom thoughts. For instance, you can bring in the thought, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. You can bring in the thought, this is dukkha. This is suffering. For me, that reflection helps to point me to the fact that this is the first noble truth. What I'm experiencing, if I'm experiencing suffering, the action that we are encouraged to take around suffering is to understand it. This is suffering. Can I understand it? Another reflection that I find very helpful, and this one will take a little bit of description, but the reflection I use or the thought that I use is, this is nature. And to me, that kind of encapsulates both the understanding of karma and the understanding of not-self. This is nature. Whatever is happening right here and now is a result of things that have happened in the past, of causes and conditions that have come together. So what's happening right now is kind of like a tree growing based on the seeds that have been planted in the past and the conditions that have come together. This tree is growing right now. So it's just a natural phenomenon that is happening right now. Not personal. That's the other piece. That's where it taps into the not self teaching. It's not personal. It's not about me. It's not about I or mine. It's just causes and conditions creating this experience in this moment. This is nature. So to me, when I say that in my mind, it's like that whole understanding comes along with it. That reflection on the past actions and past conditions, past causes have led to this experience. Not much I can do about that. It's just here right now. That reflection helps me to be just with it here and now. So using wisdom reflections. There's also a formal practice of equanimity, which helps to cultivate this quality of equanimity. And the reflection that's used, when I talked about the formal practice of metta last week, the formal practice of compassion and sympathetic joy, I talked about using the phrases. So the reflection on each of these qualities uses thought. So the metta thoughts, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, may I live with ease. The compassion thought of, may I be free from this suffering, may you be free from this suffering. The sympathetic joy thought that we bring in, may your happiness increase, may your happiness continue. The reflection for equanimity is using the reflection of karma. And the phrase is, the traditional phrase for cultivating equanimity is, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. So this equanimity is cultivated, the formal practice of equanimity is cultivated for others and for ourselves. We typically don't start with ourselves with equanimity. We start with a neutral person, somebody we don't know very well, with equanimity, because that's the easiest person to have this kind of a thought around. Someone who's a very dear friend, a beloved mother, father, grandmother, son, daughter, reflecting this way about them can be challenging. But it's a truth. Each person has to make their own choices. We can't wish for them to be happy. We can wish for them to be happy, and we do wish for them to be happy. That's what the metta practice is about. But their happiness or unhappiness isn't going to be because we've wished it for them. It has to be because they choose skillfully. So this is the traditional phrase, you are the owner of your karma, or I am the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends upon my actions, not upon my wishes. So simply wishing something isn't enough. We need to move that into action. Act skillfully. There's some alternative phrases that can be used here. For that one sometimes seems a bit cumbersome. So some alternatives might be, may we accept things as they are? So this points to the just that accepting, that non-reactivity, accepting things as they are. I wish you happiness, but I cannot make your choices for you. It's another one that sometimes people can use. Now the equanimity here is not just about simply blindly accepting things as they are and not acting. That the point of the understanding of karma is to understand how to act skillfully. To learn what creates suffering for us and what frees us from suffering. So this isn't about just simply watching the world go by and not doing anything, but it is about making skillful choices. And we can make skillful choices with the bringing mindful attention to our experience. We can get a window of opportunity to see where these choices are happening. I'll read. The last thing I'll do here is read from Nyanaponika Thera, who wrote a beautiful article about all four of the qualities of metta, compassion, of kindness, compassion, of sympathetic joy, and equanimity. He says this about equanimity. Equanimity is a perfect, unshakable balance of mind, rooted in insight. But in its perfection and unshakable nature, equanimity is not dull, heartless, and frigid. Its perfection is not due to an emotional emptiness, but to a fullness of understanding, to its being complete in itself. Its unshakable nature is not the immovability of a dead, cold stone, but the manifestation of the highest strength. Those are some thoughts about equanimity. Are there any comments or questions? Yeah.
In the beginning, you were talking about how we shouldn't really want something to stay the same way, like, or we shouldn't, I don't even know how to say it. But basically, my question is, would spiritual security or even no self still apply to that? Not wanting that, or
there is a an interesting teaching around this, but basically. We have to, it's essentially we have to use wanting to overcome wanting. So we have to learn to want skillfully first. So to let go of the unskillful wanting and move towards the skillful wanting. Then, as we move further and further, we have to let go of all wanting. So there's a teaching called the parable of the raft. And that is that essentially, you know, you have to put together something in order to cross over a stream. So you put together this raft out of sticks and stones and, or sticks and mud and whatever to build this thing that you're gonna cross over the river on. And you have to have that while you're crossing over. But when you get to the other side of the river, you don't need to carry that raft with you. You just leave it to float down the stream. And the Buddha talks about the Dharma being similar to that raft. That you need to use it in order to cross over suffering. And when you've gotten to the other side, you can let go of it. But you can't let go in the middle, or you'll drown. So there is some skillful wanting. So there's a wanting, an aspiration, and sometimes we use the term aspiration for this, an aspiration towards freedom, an aspiration towards letting go of suffering. Now, if there is always the possibility of clinging to anything. And if you are suffering around the wanting, that's a good indication that you should probably see if you can let it go. In the phases of our practice where we need to be essentially clinging to the practices, we have to want the skillful things. Those don't cause us suffering so much in the moment. When those things start to cause us suffering, we know we need to let go of them. So don't worry about the wanting, the aspirations yet. That's just keep an eye on your suffering. Just keep an eye on your suffering. Yeah.
What if you mentioned that understanding the causes and conditions helps, or realizing that this is nature and not taking it personally? What if that doesn't help? What if understanding the causes and conditions doesn't help? And even seeing that this is nature, whatever it is you're unhappy with is nature and it's not personal, you're still unhappy with that. You're unhappy with nature of things in some situations and the way things are, even though you are not taking it personally, you're still unhappy.
I would suggest that if you are unhappy about it, there is something taking it personally. If there's an unhappiness there, there is a clinging to something. So the thing there, again, it's the same thing I just mentioned to Alfonso. What is the suffering there? Look at the actual suffering. If the suffering is around, it shouldn't be this way. I mean, yes, it's nature, it's not personal, but it shouldn't be this way. There's a clinging to that. It should be a particular way.
So how do you let go of that? That strong feeling of it shouldn't be this way, it should be this other way, but it isn't, and you have no control over it.
Yeah, the doorway is to turn to whatever the feeling is. So that feeling, it shouldn't be this way, that's what's arising right now, right? That's what's come up based on your causes and conditions, based on the situation in the world, everything that's happening. The war in Iraq, it shouldn't be this way. Shouldn't be this way.
Or the darker side of human nature.
Yes, yes.
It shouldn't be this way, and you have no control over it.
It is this way. Fighting that is holding on to some aspect of control of self. So that the instruction is to turn towards the feeling. What does it feel like to feel? It shouldn't feel that. It shouldn't be this way. What is that? As you explore that, you'll start to uncover the clinging underneath that.
I mean, in my case, when it feels that way, the two feelings associated with it are deep disappointment and or loneliness. Like, am I the only one? You know, like not really belonging to the nature that I see as undesirable. Like if this is the way certain people are and I'm not that way, then there is a loneliness associated with that and a deep disappointment.
There you just pointed to the identification. I'm not that way. It's us and them. There's a feeling of separation. So that's the clinging. That's where the suffering is in that identification with I'm this way, they're that way, there's that separation. So turning towards that feeling of loneliness, that feeling of difference, What is that feeling? Can you accept that feeling? That has arisen. Can you accept that? Without judgment, without resistance. Sometimes these things are overwhelming. If it's overwhelming, it's often helpful to let go of trying to pay attention to it. If you try to turn your attention towards loneliness and you just get sucked into the pool of loneliness, that's not so helpful. But if you can actually observe the feeling of loneliness, over time you'll begin to understand more and more about it. This takes huge patience, huge, huge patience to be willing to meet that pattern of suffering over and over and over again. Recognize when it's not there, as I pointed out. Recognize when that feeling is not there. Just meeting that suffering over and over again will begin to reveal to you how that feeling itself is constructed with causes and conditions. So again, this isn't something to believe. All that I'm asking you to do really is to pay attention to your suffering. And there are times when we pay attention to our suffering and it doesn't feel like we can do much about it. You know, we bring in all these tools. This is nature. We try to, observe it in our body. We try to, apply all the tools that we've learned, and it doesn't feel like much is happening. That's where faith is needed. That's where we need to just kind of keep turning the attention over and over again. There's a story Gil tells sometimes of chopping a piece of wood that, if you're chopping a piece of wood, sometimes the hatchet comes down and it doesn't seem like much happens to the wood. You keep hitting that wood. It doesn't seem like much is changing. And then at some point you bring the hatchet down and the wood splits. And it's not that nothing was happening in those previous hits. It was weakening the fibers of the wood. And at some point you hit it and the fibers were just weakened enough so that it split. Sometimes the way we are with our difficult experiences is kind of like that. We just have to be with it over and over again, even if it doesn't feel like there's much changing. And things are kind of slowly changing in the fibers underneath, and we may not be able to perceive it. And then someday you may notice a shift around it. And that would be like the wood splitting. So it's patience. Patience. So we need to stop. So I will not be here next week. Shaila Catherine will be here to teach. I'm going to be teaching retreat. So my wish for you is that you may explore all of these qualities: generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, kindness, and equanimity. And learn what you can from this exploration so that your practice can support all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. Thank you.